And the second case for oral argument this morning is Roth versus Farner Bakken Company. Mr. John Son, attorney from Rapid City for the appellant, and for the appellee, Mr. Gregory Erlinson, also an attorney from Rapid City. The court would note that Justice Sabers has disqualified himself, and the court has appointed the Honorable Kathleen Caldwell, a circuit judge from the Second Judicial Circuit, to sit in his place. Mr. Son, you may proceed, sir.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel, it is always an honor to appear before this court. I'm here this morning on behalf of Farner Bakken Company, asking that this court set aside an oppressive, shocking, an unjust verdict rendered approximately a year ago against Farner Bakken of $25,000 compensatory damages and $500,000 of punitive damages. We've raised a number of issues in our brief. Obviously, in the limited time we have this morning, we can't address all of them. We want to address the issues that the court wants to raise. I also want to concentrate this morning, at least initially, on the statute of limitations argument, and then jump to the damages argument concerning both compensatory and punitive damages. The court is aware of the facts of this case. It all arises out of a package of mail that was sent from an attorney in Gregory, South Dakota, to Farner Bakken's, to an address in Sioux Falls of Vending Services, Inc., one of Farner Bakken's subsidiary companies. Through no fault of Farner Bakken, it was sent to the Sioux Falls office. It was addressed to the Sioux Falls office. It was not marked personal and confidential. It was opened in the ordinary course of business. When it was opened, one of the first things that came out of the envelope was a transcript of a secretly recorded conversation between some personnel of Farner Bakken and the plaintiff in this case, Greg Roth. But let's turn to the statute of limitations argument. Everybody agrees that the statute of limitations here is 3 years. Everybody agrees that the 3-year statute of limitations expired unless there was the fraudulent concealment, unless it was told by fraudulent concealment. Now, the jury, of course, ruled that there was affirmative action and that Mr. Roth had exercised reasonable diligence. We assert to the court that that is clearly erroneous based upon the evidence in this case. And more fundamentally, if you look at the Strasburg case, it talks about how constructive notice and reasonable notice is a matter of law. It's not a question of fact for the jury. Strasburg specifically states, questions about when a plaintiff should have discovered fraud are jury issues also, unless a plaintiff actually knew of facts, putting a reasonable person on actual or constructive notice to suspect fraud. Goes on to state that fraud is discoverable as a matter of law for limitations period purposes when one receives documents putting one on notice. What is the evidence and what documents were received here? Mr. Roth, in this case, admitted that when he received the packet of information that had been forwarded to him by Farner Bakken, he immediately noticed that it was a Sioux Falls postmark. He knew that was unusual because the attorneys were out of Gregory. He immediately noticed the September 4th postmark, knew that that was unusual because he was expecting that it had been mailed earlier. In fact, it was so unusual, they called the attorney in Gregory to ask why the delay between when he thought it would be coming and why the postmark was September 4th. He also admitted that he realized immediately that the packet contained less information in it than what he had delivered to his attorney in Gregory. The letter accompanying the packet, the cover letter from the attorney in Gregory to Mr. Roth, specifically had the Sioux Falls address listed on it. These are documents, and these are factual situations that would put a reasonable person on notice to conduct further inquiry to determine whether a cause of action existed. And we assert, Your Honors, as a matter of law, that constructive notice existed and the statute of limitations applies here and bars Mr. Ross's claim. Let's turn to the issue of our request for new trial and compensatory and punitive damages. On the issue of the new trial, one of the issues that we've raised is the inflammatory and improper comments of counsel in closing argument. One of those issues involved allegations that the attorneys for Farner Bakken were involved in a cover-up of the evidence in this particular case. The counsel for Mr. Roth accused both Tom Fritz and myself of being involved in the, quote, cover-up of this evidence. As an officer of this court, I can stand before you and tell you that is not true. More fundamentally, there was no evidence admitted on that particular issue. There was nothing before the jury, nothing in evidence. It was not a proper argument to be raised at that point. It wasn't an issue in the trial. Nothing had been raised in the trial on that particular issue. It could only have been made for the purpose of inflaming the jury and causing prejudice against Farmer Bakken.
Didn't the trial court, though, make some comment to the jury when that happened, when it was objected to?
It was objected to, and the judge did make a comment to the jury on it. But again, it gets to the old, you can't even ring that bell. It's already been said, they've already been accused. We've already been accused of the cover-up. There's no testimony, there's no opportunity for us to get back on the stand and say that is absolutely untrue. The jury had already had been planted in the jury's minds. Another
implant. Is that to suggest that the jury did not follow the judge's admonition?
The judge did not admonish them to disregard it. I do not believe, Your Honor. I think the judge simply said, you recall the evidence as you see as it is. But I think you can look at the amounts of the damages awarded in this case as proof that there was passion and prejudice in the jury's ultimate verdict here. Another inflammatory comment made by counsel during closing argument had to do with the question of whether the tape recording of this conversation that Mr. Roth made was illegal. It's not an instruction that was given to the jury by the court. It wasn't an instruction that was requested by Mr. Roth's counsel. But in closing argument, Mr. Roth's counsel stood before the jury and said, it's not illegal to tape record a conversation. When we objected, the judge sustained the objection. Counsel turned right around and went on to tell the jury, the judge told me, I can't tell you it's not illegal. Or I can't tell you, so I'm not going to tell you that. But I am going to tell you that if Farmer Bakken had a cause of action here, you can bet your bottom dollar that they would have brought this up. Directly in disregard of what the court had just ruled.
But wasn't your counsel or whoever was arguing in final argument also making references to how it was secretly tape recorded, and that was really a big part of the case, that this Roth had secretly tape recorded, and it was your side that kept bringing that up, and the counsel on the other side was just reacting to that, wasn't it?
Thank you. That's a good question, Your Honor. That comes up because it applies to the context in which this whole situation arose and why Gary Schmidt, when he saw that transcript, decided to copy the file and send it on to his supervisors. There's never question, it was never brought into trial whether this was illegal or not. It comes into the context, the whole circumstances of this case, as to why Gary Schmidt felt it was appropriate to copy the package and send it on to his supervisors. So the question of the legality of the conversation was never raised as part of the trial. And yet it was brought up in closing, and our assertion is that's improper and it helped to prejudice in this particular case, particularly when it was brought right back up after the judge sustained the objection on that particular issue. There are other comments made about how Farmer Bakken was evil and a pack of jackals. Your Honors, the only reason that I can think of that these kind of comments were made in closing argument, again, was to try and prejudice the jury and get them to act out of passion as opposed to upon the evidence. And this court has not hesitated to give a new trial for misconduct of attorneys at trial. You did it in the Junge case, where there's talk about the gambling addiction of the plaintiff. In the Anderson-Johnson case, when comments were made about a Sue Happy society, the court said that we would have justified a mistrial had it been objected to at the time. And in the Kloppenberg case, when questions of insurance were brought up improperly, a new trial was granted. Mr. Roth, in this case, tries to argue that we shouldn't punish Mr. Roth based upon improper conduct of its counsel. I put to you the better question is, why should Farmer Bakken be punished in this case because of the improper conduct of Mr. Roth's counsel? Let's then turn to compensatory damages and the issue of sufficiency of evidence on the compensatory damages. In this case, the jury awarded $25,000 on Mr. Roth's invasion of privacy claim. I have searched the transcript to find testimony to sustain a $25,000 compensatory award in this particular case, and I cannot find it. Page 90 of the transcript, Mr. Roth testifies that he was upset, angry, and felt betrayed. But if you read the question says, how did you feel that morning when you learned about it? The question is limited to that morning, and his answer was he felt upset, angry, and betrayed. Page 470 of the trial transcript, again, he says the same thing, and again, he limits it to that morning when he found out. I cannot find anything in the trial transcript that says that other than that morning, he was upset, felt betrayed, and was angry.
What page was that?
Page 90 and page 478. There are no medical bills, no counseling bills, no lost wages, no pecuniary loss here. It's his testimony that he was angry, upset, felt betrayed, and then again was limited to that morning. We submit to this court that that is excessive. It's unsubstantiated by the evidence. There was lots of evidence at trial about how traumatic it was when he lost his job, how he lost weight, how he couldn't sleep, how he drank coffee, had caffeine all the time. All of that, however, does not relate to the invasion of privacy claim. That's before the invasion of privacy claim ever accrued that he was having all these problems.
Now, Judge Trimble, who heard this case, you brought a motion for a new trial in front of him after the trial. He said he felt that those damages, that $25,000, was justified.
He denied our motion for new trial or judgment NOV, Your Honor. That's correct. And we would assert that upon a full review of the trial transcript and the evidence in this case, that that's clearly erroneous and that the verdict is not substantiated.
How do you respond to the argument that this is a different kind of tort that doesn't require the kind of damages that are usually presented in a tort case?
Your Honor, it is a different type of tort, but you still have a burden of proof of showing the damages that you suffered. The law still requires him to submit what type of mental distress did he have. He still has a burden of proof of coming forward with showing what the damages are, similar to an intentional infliction of emotional distress. It's a different type of tort, but the plaintiff still has a burden of proving what he actually suffered as a result of this. And the trial testimony limits that to the morning of when he found out about this, and that he was upset, angry, and that, and does not justify a $25,000 compensatory verdict. I think a better comparison is if we look at the invasion of privacy claim that was in that wall case, rising out of Wall, South Dakota, where the employer had drilled a hole in the woman's restroom and was peeking through the peephole watching the woman use the restroom. When they found out about it, the women in that case were physically ill. One of them threw up. They had medical bills, they had counseling bills, and the jury in that case awarded $500 to two of the plaintiffs and $200 to one of the other plaintiffs. Substantially more damages than testified to in this case.
I assume that case has the name under the Wall case.
You're right, Your Honor. And I do have that. Let's see.
It's in the briefs.
It's in the brief, Your Honor.
Yes,
I know I have it. Kirsten,
okay.
And so we would submit that the compensatory damages are unsubstantiated, or the award here is not substantiated by the evidence. Let's turn to the question of punitive damages. $500,000 of punitive damages rendered in this particular case. The mail that was sent to the vending services address in Sioux Falls, not marked personal and confidential, opened in the ordinary course of business, and when opened, found a secretly recorded transcript in there. Your Honors, we submit that this shocks the conscience of $500,000 awarded against Farner Bakken in this particular case, that it's excessive, it's oppressive, and it can only be as a result of passion and prejudice. Now, when this court is reviewing punitive damages, the awards of punitive damages, there's really two avenues that we go down. The court has the state law review based upon whether it's oppressive and shocking as a result of passion and prejudice, and then we also have the constitutional review based upon the 14th Amendment as to whether this is grossly excessive and more than Farner Bakken is on notice of being subjected to in a situation like this.
They're really kind of the same, though, since due process is fundamental fairness, which is the opposite of shocking and arbitrary, isn't it?
They are very close, Your Honor, and it's very difficult to try and sort out what this court has said is the criteria for reviewing upon the state law review versus the criteria that has been set out in the BMW case as to what we review upon the constitutional issues. They're very close and they're intertwined. And as we go through those, as we talk about those, I think that what we talk about really applies to both the constitutional and
is
the
there,
so there's one big difference, and that is that under the federal review, we examine it de novo.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Whereas before, with our state review, it's more deferential.
It's more deferential, and I believe that it is an abuse of discretion under the state law review. The trial court, the Cooper case, the United States Supreme Court that was just recently issued, does clarify that the constitutional review is done de novo by this court. Let's look at some of the criteria that we follow when we're looking at these punitive damages awards. First, one of the things is the ratio of compensatory damages versus punitive damages. And granted that this court has remitted lower ratios and it's affirmed higher ratios. The BMW case, that a 4-to-1 ratio is close to crossing the constitutional lines. In this case, it's 20-to-1, a very large ratio. Even larger when you look at the questionable and uncertain source of the compensatory damages that were awarded in this particular case. But the courts also say that this mathematical ratio is of limited usefulness. So let's turn to the next one, the enormity and the nature and enormity of the wrong. And this court has talked about what we look at is the likelihood of potential harm and also the relative positions of the parties. What's the likelihood of potential harm here? Very little. We're not talking about a dangerous product put out to consumers. We're not talking about a safety issue. We're not talking about toxic waste being dumped into a river. We're talking about mail that had been sent to the vending services address in Sioux Falls and was open. We're also talking about one employee. We're not talking about a course of business that Farner Bakken was following. There's no testimony or evidence that this was done company-wide. We're talking about one employee in one instance. There's no evidence that it was done before or since. And so the nature and the likelihood of harm is very low here. You also look at the relative positions of the parties. There's no fiduciary relationship here. They're both on equal footing. This isn't like the Schaefer case where they took advantage of an elderly person and took their life savings away from them. These are people on equal footing, including Mr. Roth had in fact gone and seen two different attorneys before he was even terminated. Mr. Roth is a sophisticated person and there's equal relative position of the parties here. If you look at the third factor, the intent and the reprehensibility of the defendant's conduct, the BMW case says that this is the most important consideration that we need to look at. And in doing so, you look at the nature of the conduct and also the context in which it occurred. This court has said violence or threats of violence justifies higher punitive damages. That's not the circumstance in this particular case. Again, you have a mid-level manager who receives mail, opens that mail in the ordinary course of business. He'd opened the mail for 13 years there. It's not marked personal and confidential, and when he does, he sees the transcript come up. He openly admitted that he copied it. The people from Farner Bakken openly admitted that it had been copied and forwarded to them. And again, there's no indication that any other employee before or since had this happen to them, and it's not a company-wide policy. I think one of a good case to look at is the Pula versus Amical Oil case that's cited in the brief. It's an Eighth Circuit case, and it has really very similar circumstances as we have here. In that case, the company looked through an employee's credit card records to determine if that employee had been out spending money when they had called in sick. The court, in that case, $500,000 of punitive damages was awarded. The court in that case said, no, we're going to remit this for a new trial because those are excessively large. And one of the main reasons they said that was they looked at the question of this involved just one employee, not a company-wide policy. It hasn't happened before or since. All the same circumstances we have in this case. And it's a very good guide for remitting this for a new trial, or in the alternative, reducing the damages award in this particular case.
What brings up an issue, and maybe you've touched on it. What exact relief are you seeking from this court?
The actual relief, number one, is that the judgment be entered in favor of Farner Bakken on the statute of limitations case. On the other issues, we ask for a new trial on the issues, or in the alternative, for remittiture of the damages award, both compensatory and punitive.
In what amount? In what amount? What amount do you want remitted?
Oh, excuse me, what amount?
Do you want remitted?
On the compensatory damages, I think that that Cheerstead case out of Wall gives the court good guidance. In that case, it appeared that the damages were higher than what were testified to in this case, and that was $500 that was awarded in that particular case. That is the range that we would ask for if this case is remitted on damages for compensatory. Punitive, that's a broad issue that only the court can consider, but $500,000 is greatly excessive and shocking. Certainly shocking to us, and believe shocking to the court and to people who have reviewed this particular case.
Your time has expired. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Erlinson, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you. Can it please the court? Counsel? As a practical matter, I simply don't have time today to address all the issues and all the disputes that Farner Bakken has with what the judge did and what the jury did. My role here today is not to argue the facts, but merely to point out that there are sufficient facts in the record to demonstrate that what the jury and the judge did was correct.
Let's go right to the damages. Mr. Son is saying your client got $25,000 for a bad morning. How do you respond?
Very simply, Your Honor, the record, when read in its entirety, indicates that his damages lasted much longer than just one morning.
What were those damages?
Mr. Song correctly pointed out, he did mention, yes, I was greatly disturbed, I was angry, I was devastated. He felt that knowing that Farner Bakken took all of his materials and returned back only what they wanted to, lessened his chance for an age discrimination suit. Those damages continued and are continuing as of now. Those are permanent damages.
Is there anything in the record that shows from a legal basis that somehow his age discrimination case was weakened by opening this envelope? I assume everything in that envelope would have been discoverable by the Farmer Bakken Company on the age discrimination litigation, wouldn't it? Are you claiming some kind of a privilege?
Well, I believe, Your Honor, that the evidence demonstrated that not all of his documents came back to him. First, we don't know what those documents were. We know what kind of categories they were. Mr. Roth testified. Obviously, the jury believed. He not only gave evidence of all of these incentive awards and the documents used to support those incentive awards, which he believed he didn't get all back. He also said that he didn't know for sure if he'd received his entire compensation because he didn't get all of those incentive award documents back. Additionally, some of the other areas of concern or of documents that he didn't receive back were notes that he was specifically asked by his attorney or by a potential attorneys, one of two in this case, to generate containing anything he thought relevant to his age discrimination claim.
Where in the record does it reflect that he testified he has permanent and ongoing damage?
I don't believe he specifically said that. You're correct, Justice Sinner. He didn't say he has permanent and ongoing damage. He said.
Then what evidence did you rely upon to make that argument to this court?
Well, the evidence that we used to make that argument is that in the context that in which he replied, I guess the question was limited at the onset to how did you feel when you first discovered this. He went on later to testify the actual feelings that he had when he received it. And also, if you look at the testimony of Brenna, his wife, she testified as to the continuing nature and how it felt, how he felt when he learned of that, Your Honor.
And so how long did this go on, according to the record? Is it more than a week or 2 weeks, or what was it?
There's no specific time frame, in all honesty, Your Honor.
Do we have other case law that has upheld damage awards for no physical manifestations, not going to doctors, you know, just kind of feeling bad?
Right. No, and I think that's a good point, Your Honor. What Farner-Bakken is asking you to do here, they're asking you to impose a specific requirement on any case where there is an allegation that someone's feelings have been hurt, that they have medical bills and submit those medical bills long before they ever see an attorney to try and redress those wrongs. They're asking you to impose a requirement that they take affirmative acts and get documentary proof as to what their damages were. As other courts have pointed out in our brief, they've indicated that in these type of torts, it's difficult to show the damages. It's difficult for some people rather than other people to quantify or adequately describe exactly the effect that it's having upon them. So therefore, the cases say, we leave it to the jury to decide. We leave it to the jury to determine, to judge the credibility of that witness, to determine exactly what his damages were.
Well, did you bring in an expert witness, a lawyer, to say, well, if this evidence had not been obtained by the other side, he would have prevailed on his age discrimination case or anything like that?
No, Your Honor, we didn't. In fact, we don't know exactly what that evidence was that would have been, that was withheld. We know what kind of categories it was. And I think it's fair to say that Farner-Bakken in this case, however they want to paraphrase it or categorize it, they got a head start in litigation. They got an unfair head start in litigation.
Kind of like tape recording a conversation without letting somebody know about it on the other end.
Right, Your Honor. And there's, well, I guess I wouldn't agree with that. I think there's a fundamental difference here. It's not illegal to record a conversation. It is illegal.
Well, it's definitely a head start.
Well, and as Farner-Bakken relied upon in its arguments to the court, that conversation didn't contain anything new. Yeah. Parties actually were there and had the ability to testify at trial as to what the recollection was. The information they took from Mr. Roth was information that he generated specifically at the request of an attorney, specifically contained his mental impressions and his thoughts.
I've not read the transcript yet, Mr. Olson. Did you argue for a specific amount for compensatory and or punitive damages to the jury, or just lay it on their doorstep for their discretion?
On the compensatory damages, Your Honor?
Both.
It was, I don't believe there was an argument as okay. for a specific amount. As far as the punitive damages went, there was evidence, I believe, that 1 month's profit before taxes equated to about $500,000. And I would also tell the court, I didn't argue this case, and I didn't try this case at the lower level. Therefore, my record, or my job on appeal, or review of the record, was procedurally much the same as yours. I looked at the cold record to determine whether or not there had been an error in the law, or whether or not there were facts that justified the verdict. In this case, I believe that the real issue, considering the deference that we give to both the judge and the jury in this case, comes down to the issue of punitive damages. The specific question I submit the court will probably be faced with is the number too big? Well, what Farner-Bakken is asking the court to do is to make a public policy decision, substitute its judgment for the jury's, and say, yes, this $500,000 is too big.
Which is exactly what we did in Grinberg.
Correct, Your Honor. I submit to the court that we don't have a problem in South Dakota with runaway juries. This isn't California. I believe our juries are still an adequate barometer of the sense of moral indignation that the community may feel upon any given set of facts. In this case, considering what happened, and Farner-Bakken consistently tries to characterize it as opening someone's mail, this isn't what happened here, Your Honors. They didn't just open mail. If they opened misdelivered mail as part of an ordinary course of business, that's fine. What's the harm? That's not what the evidence showed. It's not in somebody's ordinary course of business to open up mail, legal documents, once you realize that there are the legal documents of a former employee who you know has seen counsel, who you have seen counsel for, knowing that you were going to terminate them, using those documents, passing them through the chain of command of all of these corporate executives, and then withholding some of them. There's absolutely no mention made in the argument this morning that there was a second invasion of privacy, that the letter that was sent to Attorney Cole in September of 1996 ended up in Farnerbachan's file, but it was never disclosed to Mr. Roth, even though it had been misdelivered. There's no mention of that. So I think the characterizations here of the nature and enormity of wrong are obviously disputed. The jury agreed with Mr. Roth.
One of the factors that you consider in punitive damages is the potential harm or possible harm to other victims, and you want to deter that behavior. Was there any evidence of that?
No, there wasn't, Your Honor. In fact, that brings up an interesting point about the Pola case, which was cited. In Pola, the Eighth Circuit looked at punitive damages and ultimately reversed them. If you look closely at that case, the reason why they reversed that punitive damage award was because of the district court's holding or reliance on a hypothetical as to what would happen if they would have succeeded in looking at all these credit card results for different employees without citing to specific or pinpointing specific evidence in the record of looking at the individual plaintiff's invasion of privacy. So I think that case is easily distinguishable. Considering the factors that are used in making a punitive damage award, there is, of course, a differential standard of review for all but the constitutional challenges, which are reviewed on a de novo basis. In looking at there's a myriad of ways that the standards and the rules that govern punitive damages have been articulated. It basically comes down to a test of reasonableness. It does me no good to argue the numbers or the ratios or the percentages of net wealth to the punitive damages because awards greater and lesser have been awarded on both sides. The amount of compensatory damages, it was brought out in Farnerbachan's original brief and in the reply brief. They relied on Lessinger and said that an award of 9-1 was reversed as being flagrantly excessive and outrageous, shocking to the court. In that case, the court reversed, I believe, based primarily upon the fact that there wasn't any evidence in the record concerning the wrongdoer's financial condition. And in light of the amount of punitive damages given in that case, the court said, we have to reverse it. Here, there is substantial evidence of the financial condition of the defendant. There's been an argument made as well in the briefs that we use the wrong years, we use the wrong time frame to determine the culpability, financial culpability of Farnerbachan. I point out to the court that this was a problem that was created primarily by Farnerbachan. Farnerbachan refused to produce financial records during the course of this trial, or during the course of discovery, I'm sorry. That led to a motion to compel. Didn't comply with a motion to compel. That led to a motion to compel compliance with the court's previously granted order. Still didn't produce it. We're 3 weeks before a trial until finally some, but not all, of the documents are produced. So I think that any problems with what time period to award punitive damages on fall squarely at the feet of Farnerbachan.
How does the timing of when they release their documents tell us when the damages should be assessed, or the amount of damages, or the amount of the company is worth?
Well, it's related peripherally, Your Honor, I believe. I think the most important factor is to determine, under our analysis in our brief, under successor liability, I believe it's important to look at not necessarily the timing of the events. I think it's important to look at necessarily the responsible parties, because with punitive damages or any type of damages, we don't want to punish somebody that's innocent. In this case, nobody in the ultimately consolidated company, none of the executives, were innocent. It wasn't just one employee stealing or ferreting out someone's legal documents. The employee, once he received them, he passed it on to a part owner of the company, of the Sioux Falls branch, He passed it on to a board member in Carroll, Iowa, who is also a part owner of a different branch, as they allege. And it was ultimately given to the president of Farner Bakken Company. So by punishing Farner Bakken and looking at its position in 2000, rather than 1996 when the invasion occurred, I believe we're getting closer to the time when Mr. Roth actually discovered the invasion. So it's closer to the time when his damages were incurred, and it's also punishing those who were responsible.
Was this jury verdict unanimous, if you know? I realize you weren't there.
I'm sorry, I don't know, Your Honor.
Okay.
Considering the second factor, the nature and enormity of the wrong in assessing punitive damages, I don't think it can be disputed, although it's been tried, that there are far less absent physical injury, far less egregious things that someone can do than to take somebody's mail and gain a head start. This case isn't just about taking mail, as I said before. It's about taking legal documents in advance of a trial, which I believe the jury had sufficient evidence to determine. Everyone thought here that there was probably going to be a trial, considering the relationships of the party, the circumstances that led up to the firing, the animosity between some of the employees and Mr. Roth. I believe that this court should not accept what the jury clearly rejected, and that is that this was done in the ordinary course of business. Their argument that this was done in the ordinary course of business simply evaporates by Mr. Schmidt's admission that when he received the documents, when he opened them, he knew they were meant for Mr. Roth. He knew that they came from an attorney. He knew that they were sent to him mistakenly. And if we look at the cases, I apologize for jumping around, but if we look at the cases on invasion of privacy for taking someone's mail, it's not just the taking of the mail. Somebody gets mail at a business addressed to a former employee, perhaps there are certain circumstances that they might be able to open that mail, and they reasonably do open that mail, anticipating that it was something for the company. The other cases that I've cited in our brief shows that it's not just the opening of the mail, it's the things that are done after the opening of the mail, the reading of the mail without authorization. They knew they didn't have authorization to read the mail. It's the dissemination of the mail. It's the copying of the mail. And most importantly, I believe, it's the withholding of the mail that was unchallenged, or at least the jury believed that they withheld the mail, putting him in a precarious position of not having what he believed to be all the facts necessary to support his claim of age discrimination. Now, they fault us for not appealing the age discrimination claim. Well, that's a two-edged sword. One, Mr. Roth believes that they didn't return all of his documents that supported that age discrimination claim. In considering the deferential standard review for a jury, I'd have to concede there was enough evidence there to find against him on the age discrimination claim. I believe there was also enough evidence to find in his favor on that claim. However, we didn't appeal that. But I think it's still relevant to show what kind of damages Mr. Roth sustained. Now, the third factor, degree of reprehensibility on the punitive damage analysis, has also been stated by this court that is one of the most important factors. And how do we determine degree of reprehensibility? We look at what the intent is. Of course, Farner Bakken didn't get up there and say, our intent in taking, intercepting, utilizing, and withholding Mr. Roth's mail was to gain an unfair advantage in litigation. But I ask you, I'm sorry, I know I can't ask you questions, but what purpose could they have treated his mail in this manner other than to gain an unfair advantage in litigation they knew was forthcoming? There is no other reason than to take an unconscionable advantage of this man. Farner Bakken has also claimed that it didn't have fair notice, that what its conduct would lead to, the severe punishment that it would lead to in making a due process challenge. I submit to the court that everyone knows that it is wrong to take and steal people's mail. That's exactly what happened here. So they were on fair notice. Briefly, if I may, touch up on the issues regarding the closing arguments. If you look closely at the record, several of the arguments that they raise now here were not raised at the trial court level.
You mean they didn't object about these comments like jackals or conspiracy?
Correct, Your Honor.
All right.
With regard to the alleged cover-up, a fair reading of the record indicates that the cover-up was in response to an inference made by Farner Bakken. Farner Bakken was the one who said, we didn't take any of your documents. We didn't mix up your documents that we took from you and shuffle them through all the discovery that was ultimately disclosed. They said, when questioned to determine who could have done it, they said, we were the only ones that had it other than our attorneys. Well, Farner Bakken then went on to try and prove that maybe Ms. Pokchup withheld or lost some of the file materials. She denied it. They chastised Mr. Roth for not being able to or not creating an index of everything that he thought that he had given her in the first place. So I think that any inference that counsel was engaged in some sort of a cover-up, while perhaps less than artfully stated, was clearly supported by Farner Bakken's own testimony.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired. Mr. Son, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you. The weakness of the compensatory damages award here is evidenced by Mr. Ross' attorney's inability to point to anything in the record to justify the $25,000. Again, the testimony relates to the morning that he found out. The Brianna...
Well, he's now expanded it beyond saying he felt bad to say that it damaged his age discrimination case because there was documents that were never returned to him.
Your Honor, that was not presented to the jury. The jury was not instructed that that was a measure of damages that could be awarded. That's something that they're coming up with on appeal to try and justify an unsubstantiated verdict. And the jury instructions certainly didn't address that the jury could award damages for any kind of harm that it caused to the age discrimination claim, and that issue wasn't tried to the jury or to the court. And the age discrimination claim, that's not been appealed in this particular case. There wasn't evidence presented at trial that these documents somehow hurt the age discrimination claim, and again, the jury wasn't instructed on that.
Did the jury hear testimony, though, that there were documents that Mr. Roth thought that he didn't get back, that were kept from him?
Mr. Roth did testify that he thought there were documents that were not returned to him that he had given to his attorney.
In reading the record, I understood that he thought he had given about 200 documents to Mr. Johnson's law firm. He got back about 12 documents. Am I right?
I can't tell you if the 200 pages of documents is accurate, but he testified that he got back less than what he gave to Attorney Johnson. Now, it was more than the 12 pages. Gary Schmidt said that he wasn't sure. He thought maybe it was about 12 pages. Mr. Roth testified, no, it was far more than 12 pages that I got back in the packet, but I did notice that it was less than I initially had given to Attorney Johnson.
Did I make up that number of 200, or did somebody testify to that?
Stephanie very well could have said 200, or Mr. Roth could have said 200.
Okay.
I invite the court to read through Brianna Ross' testimony in this particular case. That's one of the issues cited to substantiate the $25,000 compensatory. Her testimony is limited to an answer saying when he got back from the deposition, he was upset. And then she went on to say, I noticed he didn't sleep well, and he drank a lot of coffee. But if you read her entire testimony, that's the same thing that Mr. Roth had done from the time that from before he was terminated, all the way through the process, that he had trouble sleeping and that he drank a lot of coffee. So I invite the court to read all of Brianna Ross' testimony on the issue of damages. And again, it does nothing to substantiate an award of $25,000 in this particular case. This court is an important check and balance on the court system. The jury system typically does work well in South Dakota, but this court has not hesitated to send back awards or to reverse awards or to remit awards when this court feels that they are unsubstantiated or that they're excessive or oppressive. And that's an important check and balance role that this court plays. Talked a little bit about the financial condition of Farner-Bach, and this punitive damages award is one whole month of income pre-tax to Farner-Bach. All of these companies, everyone working there, has to work an entire month to pay for a punitive damages award in this particular case. And that's all the combined Farner-Bach companies. Again, what was introduced at trial was a 2000 tax return. This incident happened in 1996. After that, Farner-Bach substantially reorganized and incorporated under one Farner-Bach company. The numbers are grossly out of proportion as to what Vending Services Inc. was in 1996.
Of course, in Vita versus Kennedy, the defendant there lost a heck of a lot more than a month's income, and we affirmed it.
And in Schaefer, it was one day income,
right,
that you looked at. This court has looked at again, different
affirmance.
An affirmance, but relying upon that this is one day of income to this company as part of the affirmance of that particular case. And the court has
ever reversed the case because it took too significant a portion of the defendant's income in a punitive case?
I can't say that there's any case that you specifically reversed. I think there are cases, there was a case, I believe, where it was a substantial amount of the defendant's assets where it was reversed. But I can't specifically tell you the name of that particular case. Now, today, Mr. Roth also argues that if this had only been an issue of opening the mail, what's the, in ordinary course of business, what's the harm? That's not what was presented to the court, however, to the jury in this particular case. That was one of the issues presented to this case. In fact, I remember specifically the opening argument of Ross counsel talking about how when Gary Schmidt got this envelope, he knew that it was from his attorneys, and he took the knife and he couldn't wait to plunge it into that envelope and rip it open and see what attorney Ross or what Ross attorneys had to say about it. The opening of the mail in the ordinary course of business was something presented to the jury. And this morning they say, what's the harm in that? That's not part of the claim. Now they also talk about on that, I need to talk a little bit about this, that financial information. There was an allegation that somehow Farner-Bach was withholding financial information through the course of this litigation. I do not see that raised in the brief, and I haven't gone back and reviewed the entire file for that, but I don't recall that being the case. I do recall that approximately a month before trial, we had the punitive damages hearing under the statute that allowed for the court to determine whether there was substantial evidence to justify submitting punitive damages to the jury and to justify discovery on punitive damages. That wasn't held until a month before trial that they finally got the required statement from the court saying that, yes, we're going to submit punitive damages and you can do discovery on that particular issue. At that point, my recollection is Farner-Bach did turn over financial information of the companies, including the year 2000 tax return, but also including other financial documents of Farner-Bach relating to 1996, 1997, 1998, and 1999. Other considerations, one thing that we didn't talk about that the court looks at when determining punitive damages is what other type of remedies are there out there, or how does this compare to other type of remedies to put Farner-Bach on notice that this type of award could be given. There was a state statute about opening mail that made it a criminal penalty, but our legislature repealed that back in 1975 or 1976. Roth cites a federal statute about interfering or tampering with mail that imposes a $10,000 fine, certainly far different than the $500,000 punitive damages award that was given in this particular case. We assert that any one of the issues that we've raised this morning justifies a new trial. We further assert that when you look at all of these issues collectively, it substantiates that this was a verdict given as a result of passion and prejudice, and we ask that it either be sent back for a new trial or that it would be substantially reduced to better suit the circumstances and provide justice to all the parties.
Excuse me, what would you do, what would happen differently if you got a new trial?
We would have a new jury, allow them to consider the evidence, let them without the influence of passion and prejudice and the improper statements being made and the other issues, allow them to consider the evidence and make their decision as to what would be a fair verdict.
So without what you're calling the improper statements in closing arguments, the trial could be the same, just with different people?
No, Your Honor, I think it would be a situation where that's just one of the factors that goes into showing that this court, that this jury acted out of passion and prejudice. The very amounts of awards given by them as it relates to the evidence that was given shows that this jury acted out of passion and prejudice. A number of circumstances built in to what the jury did in this particular case, and we ask that it be sent back and a new fair and impartial jury be given the same evidence and allowed to make the decision. It is, again, an honor to appear before this court. As an officer of the court, I greatly appreciate this opportunity. It's also an honor to appear before some of you for the very first time, and I thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.